I'm happy to have you here.
Thank you.
It's glad to.
I was trying to think this morning. Is this the fourth show? Fourth time I've been here? Fourth or fifth time?
I think it's the fourth time you've been here.
Okay.
And you always bring like great show tunes as well. So we're here to talk about obviously the next VOC
upcoming on Friday
Harmonic Extravaganza. This Friday at the Registry Theater,
yes.
Which is my, you know, all-time favorite, one of
yes.
my favorite venues in town, has been for years. And these events that you put on
are
the perfect venue to do this because of the 15 by 15 foot screen.
Yes.
And you always do these lovely early 1900s black and white silent horror features.
Well, not all horror. We did
Charlie Chaplin.
We did the comedies. We did Keaton and Chaplin. And
yes, sorry. Film features. But this time around, you're going back to horror, and it's a 1928.
Well, it's not horror.
It's not horror?
No.
Okay.
Well, it's horror-esque.
Horror-esque?
Let's say it's just, you know, melodrama.
Oh, yes. Okay. It is.
Okay.
It's called The Man Who Laughs.
Man Who Laughs.
Mm-hmm.
Based upon the Victor Hugo short story.
Okay.
L'homme qui rit, I believe, is how it's... that was not a good French accent. But yeah, no, a 1928 film directed by Paul René.
Yeah.
Who's a German director.
Yes.
And stars Conrad Veidt, who is one of my favorite actors. Of this era, who was in movies we've done. He was in Ken and Dr. Caligari.
Right.
And he was also in Hands of Warlock.
Right.
And also then successfully made the transition to talkies.
Isn't he kind of a Lon Chaney-esque type of guy?
Not so much.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know his career all that well, but I mean, I think this was kind of the one film where he was, you know, kind of in, I don't want to say disguise, but he was kind of relying on the, you know, prosthetics to kind of, you know, convey the character, so.
Right. And there's a famous actress in this film as well.
Mary Philbin?
Yeah.
Mary?
Yeah.
Mary Philbin. I brought notes as well, because I don't, yeah, Mary Philbin, who was in Phantom of the Opera.
Yes.
With Lon Chaney.
Yes.
Who actually, Lon Chaney was supposed to be in this movie.
Yeah, what happened there?
He was under contract with a different studio.
So that kind of stuff has been going back, that goes back years.
Yeah.
Well, I can't do the movie because I'm already signed
yeah,
up to
I'm under,
movie.
I'm under, I mean,
I'm
I mean,
under
this
another?
Was, well, I mean, this was back in the day of, you know, you would sign a contract with the studio and you would be in for 8 or 10 pictures or whatever. And,
yeah, and
if you
walked, you were gone, basically, right?
We saw over Christmas, we rented North by Northwest.
Oh, Alfred
Hitchcock. And I was reading about it, and apparently Cary Grant was kind of the first big name to kind of break the studio contract.
Really?
Cycle. I guess he had signed.
I didn't know that.
He had signed a contract to kind of get started.
Yeah.
And it ended, and I guess he was kind of told to re-sign or give the option to re-sign, and he kind of said, "No, I'm going to go picture to picture. I'm going to go as an independent freelancer." And his career obviously did quite well, and I guess that kind of started other actors saying, "Well, I don't want to sign a contract either. I don't want to sign a 15-year contract with MGM."
So he
set
a precedent.
Exactly. He kind of busted the union, you know, in a way. But yeah, no, Mary Philbin, who had been in Phantom of the Opera before this. I guess her career didn't really do all that well, unfortunately. And I reading up on her, I guess she had a lot of, I guess there were some parental issues.
You know,
kind of a weird mother and stepfather, and
kind of pushed her around very early age.
And I think this was kind of pretty much, I guess, one of her last big movies. And after that, she kind of disappeared and kind of faded away and kind of
faded away into the
faded away.
Black and white,
her
white screen gone.
She was the special guest of honor when the Phantom of the Opera opera debuted in Los Angeles.
Yeah, because she died in the 1990s, I think.
Yeah, she was the special guest of Andrew Lloyd Webber for the premiere performance. So at least she got a little bit of due.
Yeah,
from
which
but,
is good, which is great.
Yeah.
So how did you I think I always ask you this question. How did you pick this movie? Why?
How do we pick this movie? I don't know. If you've seen any pictures about the movie, you know that the star of the movie has a rather wide grimace, smile pasted upon his face, which is integral to the movie.
Yes,
but Bob Kane and I forget the other guy's name. They started the Batman comic strip, and I guess they were looking about for
a villain.
Yes. And they said, you know, we need a bit of a catch. He needs to have a thing.
Yes.
And even though Conrad Veidt in this movie plays the hero, they took it and said, well, we're going to use this as the villain. And so the Joker was born, and, you know, varying degrees for stories about his origin. Love the second Batman, where, you know, Heath Ledger has like three or four different stories as far as how he got the grin and you know, why
I
so glum.
Like Jack Nicholson as a Joker too. I remember when you know when he kind of, if anybody haven't seen the movie, too bad. when he's lying on the ground and he's, you know, he's all broken up and all you hear is this the laugh box.
Yeah,
that freaked me out.
Yeah,
that freaked me
out. I have a certain fondness for the Cesar Romero.
Well, he was very good too.
From the TV
show.
Very
campy.
It was very campy, and
Adam
the TV
West,
show and his Burt and
Ward.
his laugh was
yeah.
He kind of did that kind of high pitched and jumped around in the in his purple suit and stuff like that.
Yeah, but I can see why people don't like clowns, because they're always smiling, right? And it's kind of creepy when you think about it. But we should rewind back to why we're talking about the Joker, because it has everything to do with the plot of this film.
Well, the movie is the story starts. I mean, it actually is a relatively involved movie. This is not just kind of a really linear, straightforward, you know, good guys, bad guys plot.
No, it's fairly
involved. It starts off in the era of King James II, so that's kind of late 1700s. 1690.
Yes.
And I mean, and he's you know, the only really historical figure in this, but a traitor, someone who's committed treason, is found and brought before him and is killed. And before the count's death, he asks after his son, and the king says, oh yeah, you know, we found the son. Oh yeah, and by the way, we sold him to these child-stealing gypsy doctors. Compraccio is the name given by Victor Hugo, which is a bit of a made up term, but these are people from folklore who would steal children and then basically turn them into human bonsais, and would stunt their growth or maim them, all for the purpose of selling them to freak shows, or to the noble houses of the time, because everybody needed a court jester.
Yes. Yeah.
Not a jester. And so anyway, so the kid is sold, and the father, you know, cries in anguish. Then the movie cuts ahead a couple years, and the king has now ordered all the Compraccios to leave England. And so they do, and they leave the son behind because he's a witness. He's evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So he's wandering around. It's this really weird Antarctic like scene of snow and ice and though allegedly happening like in Cornwall or something like that. Anyways, he finds a baby in the snow, and he's wandering around and he comes upon the caravan of he calls himself a philosopher. He's really more like a charlatan kind of mountebank kind of character named Ursus. And anyways, as it's revealed there, the child by the name of Gwynplaine has a smile permanently etched into his face.
Yeah.
And that's where kind of the first that scene ends. You then cut ahead about 20 years, I guess, maybe a little bit longer. And now Ursus and Gwynplaine and the girl, whose name is Dee, they are now a traveling show. And Gwynplaine is a clown.
Which makes sense.
Which makes sense. Actually, historically not accurate. The first painted face clown appeared like 50, 70 years later. Anyways, they go in the countryside. They do a play called L'Homme qui Rit. Gwynplaine is eventually identified. One of the gypsy doctors has snuck back into England, realizes this could be used as leverage, blackmail against the king. Actually, now it's Queen Anne. And the jester from King James is now in the court of Queen Anne. And the Gwynplaine's father's estate has passed on to the Countess Duchess Josiana, who looks a lot like Madonna, a Russian woman who did not make the transition to talkies because of her thick Russian accent, from what I read. Anyways, the Gwynplaine's estate has now passed to her. The jester doesn't like her, isn't particularly fond of her. He's trying to ingratiate himself to the queen, who doesn't like her either, and says, oh, by the way, the rightful heir to the estate has resurfaced. And for the Duchess to maintain the estate, she should have to marry him. But he doesn't love the Duchess. He loves Dee.
That's right.
Who's blind.
Blind, yeah.
Blind, and you know, is a very poignant love story, because he's too embarrassed by his smile that he doesn't feel that he can actually deserve any love.
Beauty and the Beast.
And then it all comes to the kind of swashbuckling conclusion. With them sword fighting around the town. Gwynplaine has refused the estate. He renounces it, renounces the lordship that he was to be given because of it, embarrasses the queen in the process, and is trying to run away to join Ursus and Dee, who have been told to leave the country, and so then we've got you know the jester trying to keep Gwynplaine here and all that, and it does have a happy ending.
Don't tell us.
Unlike Hugo's original story, in which basically everybody dies.
Well, that's Victor Hugo for you.
But this movie, does have a happy ending. And yeah, and it's this weird balance, because the German director, German star, taking place in you know early 1700s England, but yet it still has this very German expressionistic feel to it, you know the sets and
yes.
you know the shadows and the lighting and all that. Certainly they weren't trying to make a I don't want to say a period piece, but you know they kind of really weren't trying to hide, or the director Paul Lenny wasn't, was just doing what he felt natural doing, which was the very German expressionistic
film style
approach. Yeah. So, anyways, I mean, that's a lot of a movie, and
it is. So,
but it is good. I mean, you've got the love story, you've got little treason and hate and revenge. At the end, you've got this kind of sword fight. There's a dog in it as well. Ursus has a pet dog. This is where it gets a little perhaps politically incorrect by these days, but
well, it was the
but Ursus
1700.
Ursus, being a philosopher, gave his dog an ironic name, which he gave him the Latin word for man. Is what he called him, which is homo.
Homo, yeah.
And so there's a couple scenes where Ursus in calls to the dog, and tells homo to be quiet and all that. So we know there'll be a couple snickers out of the audience for that. But,
For sure. So how does the music? How did you find the music to accompany?
Well,
the film, like,
we're doing two different. This movie actually had a hit single written for a song called Love Comes Stealing, mm-hmm. Which I have. I brought a version of, sung by Frank Munn, who we all know was the star, made a star by the National Palmolive Radio Show from 1917 to 1921. Anyways, and then the other music that we're doing is that, thanks to the wonders of this thing called the internet, I found a compilation of dance music from the time, from the late 1600s or early 1700s. And it's all very, you know, you can almost see, you know, the Morris dancers out there doing this kind of very, you know, square dance-ish kind of moves and all that. We of course don't do it straight up. We're not here to recreate, but I kind of went through and said, okay, you know, this song is for this scene and this song's for that scene. And then,
so you might just to interject, well, here, do you have any like sort of carnival music, like Painted Caravan?
No.
Okay.
No. Well, I mean,
freak show.
You know, we do try to kind of let the music let the film set the tone, and
yeah,
and you know, I mean, the music is certainly kind of bouncy and kind of jaunty, you know, all on its own. You know, we don't for those of you that have been to our show, you know that we don't do things straight up, and there's
no, and people often love your, people love your shows. They would come to the video store and rave at me,
really,
about them after the fact.
Oh, that's great.
Yes,
that's
yes.
Great. But no, we don't do things straight up. We don't, we always kind of, well, we rehearse so that people kind of know the tune and know who's playing and all that. And then we just say, you know what, just do whatever you want. And, you know, everybody is comfortable enough with each other that, you know, I think we can, you know, bake a pretty good cake.
Yeah, you do. You know, so. Just for people who don't know, who are the members of VOC?
Well,
Philharmonic?
Bradford Nowak, yep. Is on drums. I don't know if he's bringing his trumpet for this one. I think he is. Bradford is now also a new member of My Sweet Patootie, the Owen Sound-based folk trio now.
Oh.
We have David Hunsberger, mm-hmm. Famous local artist on clarinet. A regular, I think it's a B-flat, and bass clarinet. We have Steve Lederman out of Toronto, who spent his time in 80s hair metal bands back in his youth, but now...
What? I'm just curious.
What was the name of the band? What was the name of the band? I'm sorry. You can Google
Room of Fools? Or?
You can Google... No, okay. It's... Reckless or something like that.
Reckless.
It might have been. Anyway, so Steve plays a lot of drums and percussion. I think what he'll be doing mostly for this one though is gongs.
Gongs. That'd be beautiful in that space.
He's also becoming more and more proficient with low brass. Mm. At the Chaplin, he had a euphonium.
Okay.
Which is tuba-like.
Yeah, tuba-like instrument.
And he
that's
also
right.
has, I think it's a bass trombone. I think he also played. We have Wade Whitaker on guitar, acoustic, electric, and then there's myself on. For this gig, it's going to be it's double bass, but Wade and I do kind of like our effect pedals, so at times you'll be hearing sounds that you didn't think could come out of
a bass.
Our instruments, but we have all kinds of wizardry and gadgetry available for our sonic pleasure, and hopefully yours as well.
I have a question here.
Okay.
You know, for the other shows that you've done,
yeah.
Do you guys have any recordings of these?
We do record ourselves.
Okay.
Mostly for our own edification. I have gone back and listened to some of our stuff, and I guess ultimately perhaps for the better, just on its own, it at times doesn't really work.
Okay.
You're kind of listening to it and you're thinking, oh, okay, well, that's kind of interesting. And then it kind of will kind of maybe hover around. It doesn't move as much.
No, I guess it
as
is.
because we're there.
You're following a film.
We're following the film.
More filmic in nature.
Yeah. So you know, if there's a fairly, you know, dramatic scene, we'll kind of maybe, you know, hover on a feeling and not move from that too much, because we don't want to distract.
Yeah,
from the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, these are all great movies.
You're another dimension.
Well,
they don't sonic dimension.
They don't need our help.
Yeah.
You know, so we're there to kind of help support. A few people have come up afterwards, and I've taken this as a huge compliment. They said, there are times when I even forgot you guys were playing the music.
Oh, that's great.
Which I think great. I mean, I'm glad that we've kind of worked ourselves into the music that we're not obvious. It's not, oh, hey, look at the five guys on stage making noise that has nothing to do with what's going on the screen. So I'm glad that we can kind of work our way in. I mean, we're not doing, you know, big... you know, John Williams overtures
This is like an accentuation.
I always tell the guys, I tell everybody, it's always better to kind of underscore, to kind of, you know, you can get a lot more mileage out of underplaying than overplaying. And there are times where you, if you can kind of find the right notes or the right chord or the right kind of riff that, for lack of a better term, you just milk it for all it's worth. You know, you don't need to think people are getting bored because, you know, we're there to support.
Yeah, exactly. And why don't we take a musical break and play this?
You've got Love Comes Stealing, I think. I pulled this off of archive.org. So yeah. it is from a 78. So it's not
amazing.
It's certainly better quality than some of the other 78 recordings they have, but it does have a bit of a warble.
I have a question. Do we call you the artistic director of VOC Sovereign Harmonic? Do you have a moniker?
No.
Right.
No. I'm just kind of, you know, the guy.
The guy. Well, this is Coral FM, and I'm here with the guy from VOC Silent Film Harmonic. And this is Love Comes Stealing from 19...
When was this? 1928. This is Frank Munn singing with the, I believe it's the Regent Club Orchestra backing him up.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Love Comes Stealing from Frank Munn. Oops. That was Love Comes Stealing from Frank Munn on Coral FM. And here is another wee surprise that Ted Harms brought me on the same CD.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz?
This is from Jesus Christ Superstar.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. 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 What should you want to know? Don't you mind about the future? Don't you try to think ahead? Save tomorrow for tomorrow. Think about today instead. Oh yeah. Oh, I could give you facts and figures. Yeah, I could give you plans and hopes. Yeah. Even tell you where I'm going. To know why you're obsessed with fighting. Times and feet you can't defy. You knew the path we were riding. You'd understand it less than what's I would. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Let me try to cool down this beat. Let me try to cool down this beat. Let me try.
Mary, oh, that is good while you prattle through your supper. Where and when and who and how? She alone has tried to give me what I need right here and now.
His time on women of her kind. Yes, I can understand that she amuses, but to let her stroke you, kiss your head is hardly in your line. It's not that I object to her profession, but she doesn't fit in well with what you teach and say. It doesn't help us if you're inconsistent. They only need a small excuse to put us all away.
Who are you to criticize her? Who are you to despise her? Leave her, let her be now. Leave her, she's with me now. If your slate is clean, then you can throw stones. If your slate is not, then leave her. Amazed that men like you can be so shallow, thick and slow. There is not a man among you who knows or cares if I come or go.
Okay.
So what do we have there? We had Frank Munn singing Love Comes Stealing.
Right.
And then on the Mary Philbin, Andrew Lloyd Webber connection, we got into Jesus Christ Superstar, the 1970 rock opera.
Featuring
Ian Gillan of Deep Purple fame.
Smoke on the Water. I used to like Highway Star. That was my favorite Deep Purple tune.
He was also in... He did one album with Black Sabbath.
Yeah, that's right.
Don't forget. I believe the hit single from Born Again was the song Zero the Hero, and all that, which was and that was the great Yvonne Elliman as the female backup.
She's awesome.
Who had numerous hits and was Eric Clapton's backup singer for about 1,200 albums.
Yes, at least.
And then we on the Conrad Veidt inspiration for the Joker theme, we just played some of Prince's music for the very first Batman movie, which was 1989.
Right, that's right.
It was a hugely hyped movie.
Yeah,
all spring and all summer, and I saw it, and I was all done with it, and I thought, you know what, it's great. It was cool. It was nice to look at.
Campy.
But then I was off to Europe. I went to Europe for some of that fall, and I was thinking, I'm gonna thankfully get away from the Batman hype. And of course, I get there, and guess what movie is released in like mid October?
Yeah, always 6 months. There's a 6 month difference between us, the U.S. and England.
So I got more Batman, you know, Auf Deutsch and all that, you know, when I was in Europe, and so I couldn't escape Batman that year. It was everywhere.
Oh, man.
So, getting back to The Man Who Laughs, it's this Friday, 8 o'clock at the lovely Registry Theater, run by the
lovely
and talented, and where would we be without him,
Lawrence McNaught.
The tickets are $15 at the door. You can buy them advance, $15 for the center and the square. If you buy them at the door and bring in a food bank donation, a 99-cent can of beans gets you $5 off the price.
Very cool. So
that's $10 plus the food bank donation. And high school students, $5 IGO tickets.
Two IGO? Yeah.
So that's this Friday at the Regi on Frederick. I forget the exact address.
122
Frederick Street. Apologies in advance that parking sucks. But just find a side street, you know, or you can probably maybe park down by Center Square if there's nothing going on.
Yeah,
as well.
True that.
There will be two free tickets available to the first person that goes into Far Out Flicks and is able to tell just you or any of your staff.
Actually, any of our staff is good.
Any other staff. So you could go there right now. And the trivia question is, and no cheating looking at the poster behind the door, but what's the name of the movie on that we're playing, that we're accompanying with on Friday?
On Friday. Yeah, don't look at the poster's right on the wall.
Yeah, so right don't there. Look. Don't cheat. We don't want cheaters at the show. We only want fine, upstanding, moral citizens. And then the next show, we are on April 11th, so Thursday, April 11th, we are doing a surrealism double bill.
Oh my God, are you ever.
We are doing Un Chien Andalou.
Oh, mon Dieu. Why is Un Chien Andalou so famous?
Famous? Because it's good. Louise Bunel, Salvador Dali.
Squeamish.
Just...
A little scream.
Just the one scene. And it happens in like the first 3 minutes.
I know.
But anyways, and then what we're doing afterwards is another Louise Bunel related film, which is The Fall of the House of Usher.
Oh, man.
Which I forget what it is in French. Anyways.
Maison de
the Usher. Fall down.
Somebody knows, give us a call.
And so that's Thursday, April 11th, and that's going to be the same deal as at the Registry. 8 o'clock start, $15, $10 plus food bank donation, or $5 IGO ticket.
Yeah,
so
very cool.
So we'll try to do something surreal musically.
That'll be great challenge for you guys.
Very cool. Yeah, I mean, there was a little bit of musical surrealism. But I mean, the thing about surrealism is that it's the dreamlike state. So how do you do dreamlike music? I mean, you know, it's, you know,
with a 5-piece band, you'll figure it out.
Yeah, we'll figure something out. You'll figure it out. It'll be good.
It'll be grand.
It'll be, and I'll probably be back here.
Yes, you will be back here. I'm already telling you now.
April 10th, I guess, the day before.
Yes, we'll be you'll here. Be back here April 10th as a guest on my
show. Wednesday, and more snappy patter from me.
Yeah,
so.
For sure. No, this was great.
Un Chien Andalou, a great movie, all kinds of weird things, but I mean, I think it's kind of like beer in that after you've had three or four, or seen the movie three or four times, it does kind of make sense. It does have a bit of a rhythm to it and a bit of a pattern, and you can kind of see how one scene leads into the next. But it's I can see why this is a very well-known movie.
It is. There's a contemporary of yours that did a score for this some years ago.
Yes.
At the Registry Theater.
Yep.
My good pal Nash the Slash.
Did it.
Did not. Were you there?
Yes,
you,
I was. Did you? I was at that show.
Yeah.
And Nash did Un Chien, and he did Nosferatu.
That's right.
Nosferatu. So. And I remember he had like 80 pounds of like studio and rack gear to get all the different sounds going and all that. Which now, thanks to modern technology, you could probably have, you know, he just needs his little an iPad with him and he'd probably have everything ready to go. So,
well, I think you're the what's the next phase? Nash hasn't been doing anything in the last 5 years.
Okay,
so
he's been busy.
He's been busy. He's been underground. He's staying in his crypt. So I'm sure he'd be very pleased to know that you guys are, you know, carrying on.
We will, yeah.
The tradition, and in such a different, a very different and novel and exciting way with a 5-piece band instead of like it's just Nash all, you know, with one.
Doing everything and the crazy mandolin stuff.
Yeah.
I figured because the bandages that he could actually have like 8 or 9 different Nashes going. And
he could.
And no one would really know. I mean, it's
like out of the Matrix.
Out of the Matrix or Krusty the Clown tried in the one Simpsons episode where he had a clown school and he sold franchises.
Oh, so, he told me the secret to how he stays in that all those bandages for so long, but I will never tell.
Oh, two-sided tape or spirit gum or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Well, I have a special. I know you have to. Your boot heels have to be walking soon.
Yeah,
so
soonish.
Here is a song.
What have you got?
Here is a song just for you off Red Hot and Blue. Someone I know you really like, David Byrne, doing a Cole Porter tune called Don't Fence Me In on Coral FM.
Look at how